I'm not here to preach at you this afternoon. In the first place, I don't believe in women preachers. And in the second place, I feel pretty sure that this is not the kind of a group that needs to be preached at. The only reason that you're here is because you already know the kind of things that I like to say to women. But what I would like to do is to just encourage you in what you are doing. If I were to ask you what it means to be a woman, I wonder what your answer would be. We have heard a lot of stuff in the last few decades that has rather confused us about what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a man, and for a few years we're being told we weren't supposed to use those words at all. We were all supposed to be persons. I remember when I was speaking one time in a church in Boston, and a person started down the aisle after I finished who was obviously very angry. I wasn't sure whether it was a man or a woman. And I think you know how edgy one can feel if you're not sure what you're looking at. But as this person proceeded down the aisle with a sort of a swagger and folded arms and a set jaw, I knew I was in for trouble. It did turn out to be a girl, probably 18 or 20 years old. And the first thing she said to me was, "You know, I disagree with a lot of the stuff you say." She was chewing gum a mile a minute. And I said, "Well, fine, you're allowed to disagree with me, but it won't do me any good unless you specify what it is that you disagree with me about and why." "Well, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I just don't like a lot of the stuff you say about women." "Well," I said, "you still haven't told me exactly what it is that you don't like what I say." And she hemmed and hawed and chewed her gum for a while, and she says, "Well, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I don't really like to think of myself as a woman." There aren't too many options, are there? And so I said to her, "Well, how do you want to think of yourself?" It was pitifully obvious that she was doing her best to be as masculine as possible. Everything about her movements and her dress and her haircut and everything else were telling me that she would like to be a man. But her answer was that what she really wanted to be was a person. And we had quite a discussion, but after all, God didn't make any persons, did he, that weren't either men or women. And we are to thank God for the gift of our womanliness or our manliness, our femininity or our masculinity, and be women for God or men for God, whichever God's gift might be. But in my view, women are created to be life bearers. Because I'm a Christian, everything in life, all the visible things in the world, indicate spiritual truth. We live on the ocean, and I can look out at that vast ocean, and I can think of all these scriptures that speak of the love of God and the power of God being like the waves of the sea, or greater than the waves of the sea. You can look at thunderclouds and remember that the clouds are his chariots. You can look at a tiny bird and remember that our Heavenly Father sees the sparrows fall. When you comb your hair in the morning and lose more or less hair more and more as you get older, you begin to remember that God has them all numbered, and there's never a hair that falls without his observation. And when I look at the physical body, there can't be any argument about the fact that men were made to be initiators and women were made to be receivers, responders. We were born with the standard equipment to make us one or the other. And the standard equipment in the female body is obviously made to receive, to carry, to bear, and to nourish. And that means a great deal to me, spiritually speaking. Obviously, God does not enable all men to become fathers or all women to become mothers in the biological sense. Many women never become mothers because they never marry. Many married women never become mothers because God doesn't give them a child. Many women who marry and become mothers are not able to breastfeed for one reason or another. So the standard equipment doesn't always get used in the physical way, does it? But it is there as a continual reminder that in God's design, the original design, He made us women specifically for life-bearing. And I would like for us to think a little bit about that concept from a spiritual standpoint. Think of the physical data of your female body as being weighted with spiritual significance. And has it ever occurred to you that the Apostle Paul actually uses maternal metaphors? To the Galatian Christians, he says, I travail in birth till Christ be formed in you. He says, I was gentle among you like a nurse with her children. And in the fourth chapter of 2 Corinthians, he uses this same metaphor of carrying life in the body. He said, continually, while still alive, we are being surrendered into the hands of death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be revealed in this mortal body of ours. Thus, death is at work in us and life in you. Now, how many of you are mothers or grandmothers? Obviously, if you're grandmothers, you're also mothers. About 8 people. Oh. Well, you know that when you got pregnant, you began to realize that your life was put on the line for another life. And as that pregnancy proceeded, you began to realize more and more the awesome mystery of this human being that you had nothing to do with in designing, taking shape and taking up more and more room inside that now misshapen body. And when it came down toward the wire, toward time for that child to be born, you realized that you were going to have to put your life quite literally on the line, to go down into death, as it were, for the sake of that child. And when the child is born, what happens then? It's only the beginning, isn't it, of offering your life for that child. It's the principle of the cross at work. My life for yours. And I have opportunity from time to time, not nearly as often as I would like, to observe my daughter with her children. We live in Massachusetts. She lives in California. And all my grandchildren are in California. I only have one daughter, and she has made me a very rich grandmother. I have 6 grandchildren. The oldest is 14, the youngest is 2. And it comes home to me with great clarity when I'm visiting there that a mother's job is to be a life bearer, a receiver, a carrier, a nurturer, to be available for the life of the world. God created Eve to be the mother of the race, and instead of accepting the givens of her life to be a human being, to be a woman, to be obedient to God and cooperate with Him in His creative work, she chose to disobey and persuaded her husband also to defy God. Instead of saying, "Thy will be done," Adam and Eve said, "My will be done." The kingdom of heaven is a place where God's will is done. And obviously, there's only one other place where one can say, "My will be done." And that's hell. And the gospel the message of the cross, and I love the name of your mission, Wayside Cross, undoubtedly taken from those European wayside crosses, places which in the most remote areas of the mountains reminded travelers of Jesus Christ. And the message of that cross is always my life for yours. And so here's a whole room full of people who in one way or another, great or small, hidden or obvious, is willing to say, my life for yours. For these abused women, pregnant women, women on drugs, homeless women, children, we are the bearers of the life of Jesus for these people. We are meant to be mothers. And I say this particularly to you who have never biologically produced a child. To you singles. All of us, because we were created to be women, are created to be mothers. And if God doesn't give us biological children, God can give us spiritual children. And even if God does give us biological children, I do believe with all my heart that every single one of us is meant to mother other people. In Titus 2, 3-5, it says that the older women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands and to love their children and to be chaste and temperate and self-controlled and to stay home. And when I came in here, just as I was entering the door, what I seemed to see was just a sea of white and gray heads. And I thought, isn't this wonderful that I have this opportunity to sock it to these ladies now? Because I'm one of you. And we are most definitely older women. But you 20-year-olds, please don't forget you're also an older woman. How well I remember when I was 9 years old that my next door neighbor, Ruth Ritchie, who was 15, was my idol. She was beautiful. And I watched and scrutinized everything that Ruth Ritchie did. I wanted to fix my hair like Ruth. I wanted to dress like Ruth. I wanted to talk like Ruth. I tried to walk like Ruth. And I'm sure that to this day, Ruth hasn't the slightest idea that 9-year-old neighbor was doing that. But the thing was that Ruth Ritchie was kind to a 9-year-old neighbor girl. Not too many 15-year-old girls are going to pay a lot of attention to 9-year-olds. But I looked up to her. That's the point I'm making. If you're 20 years old, there's a 15-year-old looking up to you for a model. What is a woman? What characterizes her life? And I think of the older women who mothered me in ways that my own mother couldn't do. Now, I have had a wonderful Christian mother and father. I came from a very, very strong Christian home, and I'm thankful. And they certainly were the most powerful spiritual influences in my life. They were 7-day-a-week Christians. My father read the Bible to us and prayed with us twice a day, not just once a day, but he corralled all 6 of us into the living room after breakfast and read the Bible and prayed, and we sang a hymn. And in the evening after dinner, we could not be excused until he had read the Bible again and prayed with us again. So I owe it an utterly unpayable debt to my parents. But at the same time, there were other times in my life when I was away from them and when I couldn't have been mothered in the same way that I was mothered by older women. One of them was here at Wheaton College. My house mother in what was called North Hall in those days was a single lady who had never been married. I was one of her spiritual children. She was my Sunday school teacher. Who needs you? Well, perhaps it's never crossed your mind that you're responsible to be obedient to that passage in Timothy. Who are the older women in your church who have taken seriously the responsibility to to teach younger women to love their husbands. How many of you have never had a friend or family member who has been touched by divorce? I don't see a hand. Why is divorce almost an epidemic nowadays? Surely one of the reasons is because these young couples have never been taught by the older men in the church. The men have not been taught by the men how to be husbands and how to be fathers, and the women have not been taught by the older women how to be wives and how to be mothers. Is there anybody who hasn't seen unruly children in the church or in the grocery store? Children that are out of control, racing around, screaming and yelling, and in the grocery store grabbing stuff off the shelves and taking the candy and taking a bite out of it when they're at the checkout counter before the poor mother has a chance to get it out of their hands. Why are kids going wild? Because the young mothers don't know how to discipline them, and the young fathers are absent half the time. They don't even think of the responsibility of bringing up their children. The Bible says that the fathers are to bring them up. It doesn't say they just let them grow. They're supposed to bring them up. And who is responsible for not having taught the younger women to love their children and to love their husbands? God is going to charge you and me with that responsibility. But you have this opportunity. You have the opportunity through this mission, which is just one avenue. Don't think that that's the only one. And when you've done that, you've discharged your job. Probably you haven't, because there's probably an individual, perhaps living near you, perhaps somebody that God will point out to you that needs you as a spiritual father or mother. But here in this mission, you are given the opportunity to say, "My life for yours." As my second husband, Addison Leach, who had three daughters, used to say, babies are a lot of trouble at both ends. And children are an inconvenience, aren't they? A tremendous inconvenience. And a dear single lady that I know that loved animals as I love animals, she loved dogs and she always had a dog, but she said, "You know, your love for an animal is measured by your willingness to be inconvenienced." And certainly that would be true about children. Animals are not nearly the inconvenience that children are. Love is the measure in which we are willing to be inconvenienced. I'm sure that it's not very convenient for many of you, many times, to help in the ways in which you are needed to help in the Wayside Cross Mission. And somebody calls and your heart just sinks and think, "Oh no, I was just there last week," or, "I just did so-and-so, don't tell me they're asking me again." In 1 John 3:16, we read, "If Christ loved us and laid down his life for us, we in our turn must lay down our lives for each other." And in contrast to that example of Eve, who refused God's gift of womanhood, she didn't want to be just a woman. She wanted to be an initiator. And I believe that God created men to be initiators and women to be responders. Well, role reversal happened way back in the Garden of Eden. And we've been in an awful mess ever since. Because Eve took the initiative. Adam was what you might call a four-letter word, a wimp. And he became the responder, just laid back. And how many men do you know who just think, "Well, if that's what the little woman wants, that's what the little woman gets, because any price I'll be willing to pay in order not to get into an argument." You know, men don't want to be anywhere near screaming women, and I can't blame you men for that. But nevertheless, the buck stops with the men, doesn't it? It wasn't Eve that God called, it was Adam, and God said, "Where are you?" And Adam immediately laid the blame on the woman you gave me. And when she was confronted, she laid the blame on the snake. It's always somebody else's fault, isn't it? So they refused their humanity. Satan came along and tempted them to be gods. And they refused their masculinity and their femininity. And Eve usurped the place of the man, and Adam abdicated his responsibility to protect her, and they both sinned and brought death and destruction into the world. And as long as we continue to talk about role reversals and equality, we're going to be in worse and worse trouble. Men are not women. Women are not men. We are not interchangeable. We are not equal. We are gloriously unequal, and we were meant to be complementary, not equal. By contrast, with that woman Eve, we look at the model of Mary. A woman who was characterized by total surrender. She was a receiver, first of all, of the will of God. And when the angel came and announced to her that she had been chosen to become the mother of the Son of God, her response was instant reception, not, wait a minute, I've got my own plans. I'm going to get married. How am I going to explain this to Joseph? What will my parents say? What will the village people say? Nothing like that. Just behold the handmaiden of the Lord. Let it happen as you say. And she presented her body a living sacrifice and became for all time and eternity somebody's mother. She was willing to be somebody's mother. We are called to be mothers. You men are called to be fathers, to be responsible for the life of the world. And let me read those verses again from 2 Corinthians 4. Wherever we go, we carry death with us in our body, the death that Jesus died, that in this body also life may reveal itself, the life that Jesus lives. For continually while still alive, we are being surrendered into the hands of death for Jesus' sake. And then in another place, Paul says, I die every day. Laying his life on the line, pouring himself out, being broken bread and poured out wine for the life of the world. Surrendered into the hands of death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be revealed in this mortal body of ours. And the desperate people who come to you for help, probably most of them have never seen a living example of the love of God. They don't have the first idea of what it's about. And they're wondering if these people who started this, whatever it's called, wayside cross rescue mission, whatever that means, they must be kind of strange. They must be kind of weird to be interested in people like me. And I'm sure when they come, they must be sort of trembling in their boots, wondering what they're going to see and what they're going to get. And they will be scrutinizing you to see what makes these people do this. Are they just church ladies? They do this once a week or once a month or when it's convenient. Or is there really something fundamentally different about these people? And there certainly ought to be something fundamentally very different, visible. Because the life of Jesus should be manifest in our mortal bodies. Mother Teresa, going out there in the streets of Calcutta to collect the dying, She says to her novices who come out to learn to serve, "The people will eat you up. You cannot do it without partaking of the life of Jesus." And when Malcolm Muggeridge put the question to Mother Teresa, "What is it you're trying to do?" She said, "We simply try to do for these people what we would do for Jesus, if we could see him." And you remember that Jesus spoke these words when he spoke about, "When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me." And the listeners said, "When did we ever go to prison to see you? When did we ever see you naked? When did we ever put clothes on you or visit you?" And he said, "Inasmuch as you have done it for one of the least of these, my brothers, you have done it for me."